The following podcast contains advertising. To access an ad-free version of the Lawfare podcast, become a material supporter of Lawfare at patreon.com/lawfare. That's patreon.com/lawfare. Also, check out Lawfare's other podcast offerings, Rational Security, Chatter, Lawfare No Bull, and The Aftermath.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, cleaning, and even exercising. But what if you could be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average, and auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at Progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
The Attorney General and DHS kind of dumped this problem in Health and Human Services' lap to fix. And then beyond that, I think we do have a broader immigration law and policy question, and it's worth looking at how DHS has evolved over time. I agree with Paul that the prospects for major immigration overhaul seem unlikely, at least in the next couple years. And that's partly because even though reasonable people on all sides probably agree that things need to be fixed and modernized, the president has polarized the conversation so much and made it nationalist and ethnic-based that probably a serious policy improvement is going to be hard to come by.
I'm Benjamin Wittes, and this is the Lawfare Podcast, July 10th, 2018. Abolish ICE is the hashtag that has proliferated all over Twitter. Anger over the family separation policy of the Trump administration has many people doubting whether the agency that does interior immigration enforcement is up to a humane performance of its task. We got two Lawfare contributors in the room to talk about it. One of them, though, was in Costa Rica. Paul Rosenzweig was a policy guru at DHS, where he supervised immigration matters. Carrie Cordero has been actively engaged on the subject recently. We discussed it all. Is the problem ICE, or is it the substance of our immigration laws? Would abolishing ICE actually make a difference, or would it just be renaming the problem with three other letters? It's the Lawfare Podcast, episode 328, hashtag abolish ICE. Carrie, I want to start with a question about the phrase abolish ICE. Some people seem to be using it as a literal policy proposal, and some people seem to be using it as a phrase designed to connote dissatisfaction with current administration policy with respect to the border. How should we understand the words or hashtag abolish ICE? Should we take it seriously or literally or neither?
Well, I can tell you the way that I'm viewing the hashtag, which is in the movement to abolish ICE, if we can call it that, even though it's just emerged in the last week or two. I view it as a political slogan or a political issue that has been engaged in primarily by politicians, not by policy professionals. And I think that it has made a good soundbite to coalesce the anger and frustration that people of many different political spectrums and views have about what we're seeing on the border with the family separation issue. I think that the slogan of abolish ICE, from my perspective as a policy person who has legal and policy deep concerns about the specific, discrete issue of the family separation policy that resulted from the 100% illegal entry prosecution guideline, which I know we'll get more into, that's a very discrete issue. And I think the political slogan of abolish ICE actually detracts from the importance of that singular issue. So that's my view on it from sort of the public and political discourse of it. The fact of the matter is that as a governmental function, we could rename ICE, we could rebrand ICE, we could reorganize ICE, but we can't actually abolish the function of immigration enforcement. That is just not a way that the government can function.
So, Paul, you were around in government at DHS in the period after the last time we abolished the Immigration Enforcement Agency. Give us a sense of the history of that action, why it was taken, and why the current allocation of immigration enforcement functions exists as it does.
That's a great question, and there's a kind of deep history for it. If you put yourself back to September 10th, 2001, the day before the 9/11 attacks, the one feature of American government that would stand out, at least as most strikingly, at least as far as Homeland Security is, that the border security function was deeply fractured amongst many agencies. There was a customs enforcement group that came out of Treasury. There was an immigration enforcement group that was in the old INS, Immigration and Naturalization Services, which was in the Department of Justice. There was an agricultural inspection service in the Department of Agriculture. There was a maritime border service, the Coast Guard, that was in the Department of Transportation. And the one, you know, great change that we thought we were making with the formation of the Department of Homeland Security was to try and amalgamate all of those border security functions in a single place. And so when you go today to the border, you have only one face at the border, essentially. There's a customs and border protection officer, and the same agency does the customs functions, the agricultural functions, and the immigration functions when you enter at, say, Dulles Airport or at the border crossing in San Ysidro, California. Along with all of those administrative functions for entering people into the United States or entering goods into the United States, there was, as Carrie said, an enforcement function. There was a customs enforcement function that would go after, say, counterfeit goods or money laundering activity. There was an immigration enforcement function that would go after people who had illegally entered the country or who had legally entered and then overstayed. There was even a small agricultural enforcement function, though it was a very rare instance, as I recall it. And so at the time when DHS was reformed, it was decided to split those two groups into a regulatory group at the border, essentially, and a legal enforcement group, which became what's known as ICE, Immigrations and Customs Enforcement, which was really a conglomeration of two separate enforcement functions, the immigration enforcement function for illegal entry and the customs enforcement function for the illegal entry of goods. And meanwhile, the whole naturalization piece was hived off to U.S. Citizen and Immigration Services. It isn't necessarily the case that enforcement should have been separated from the regulatory function, but that was the decision taken by the Bush administration and by Congress back in 2003-04 when DHS was being created.
So as long as I have been an adult and aware of this set of issues, it has struck me as impressive how broad the consensus is across the political spectrum that immigration enforcement sucks. We don't agree about the way it sucks. That is, some people think we have too much of it and it's too aggressive, and some people think we have too little of it and it's insufficiently aggressive. But nobody seems very satisfied with our immigration enforcement apparatus. And every now and then we go through these paroxysms of trying to figure out how to fix it, which is sometimes about securing the border, and it's sometimes about, you know, a sort of more humanitarian objectives. And it often takes on a bureaucratic quality. Let's split up INS. Let's abolish ICE. And so my first question, I'm interested in both of your thoughts on this, Carrie, first, is all of this bureaucratic stuff just a proxy for a substantive discussion that is very uncomfortable about how much interior enforcement we want, how much border security we really want, who we do and don't want to let into the country? Or are there actually serious bureaucratic questions that exist exogenously from those substantive questions?
So I think I have two different takes on that question. One is to distinguish the current immigration debate, particularly as it has been articulated by candidate and then President Trump, which I think is a different immigration debate than has happened in the prior 30 years, sort of in our collective adult lifetime, which is to say that I think there's always been a public policy debate about the contours of immigration and amnesty we've heard about, and sort of an understanding that the system wasn't working, the immigration system wasn't working in many ways. I think that immigration debate is different than the immigration debate that the president has encouraged, which has been a more nationalist, strident, truly anti-immigrant viewpoint. And I think that in terms of our national conversation is worth distinguishing. On your point about your question or point about bureaucracy, maybe one answer to that is that the way that the executive branch, to the extent that it wants to change how it does immigration enforcement or law enforcement or make changes in these areas, to the extent that it needs Congress's action to effectuate changes the executive branch wants to make, the way it's able to get Congress to engage is to propose it in terms of bureaucratic reorganization. So in other words, if we look back, sort of if we start with the 9/11 period and we look after that, where the executive branch was able to get Congress to act was the creation of DHS, the creation of the Office of the Director of National Intelligence. That's where it gets Congress to do something when it can put forward a proposal that does bureaucratic reorganization, and then that's how the executive branch is able to adjust what it actually does as a practical matter.
Paul, what do you think? Is there a serious bureaucratic conversation to be had here, or is it just a surrogate for substantive issues? And to the extent that there is a serious bureaucratic question about ICE or CBP, what is it?
I think there is a serious bureaucratic question. I agree with the premise of your question and what I take to be Carrie's view, that to a large degree, it also masks substantive questions. But as a matter of bureaucracy, I'm of the view that, you know, form follows function and function follows form. In most regulatory agencies, which is broadly speaking what immigration and customs is, it's a series of regulations. In most of them, the criminal enforcement function is not separately hived off from the civil enforcement functions and the administrative enforcement functions. It's seen as another tool in the toolkit, but as a matter of bureaucracy and as a matter of governance, it sits in more or less the same structure as the civil and administrative functions, kind of on parallel tracks. That's true of OSHA, that's true of EPA, it's true of the SEC and other enforcement agencies. When the criminal function sits in the same place as civil or administrative, it's looked at as just one possible way of proceeding, not as the preferred way or the more instinctively correct way, but as one of several options. And judgments are made about cases on a, you know, essentially case by case or on a policy by policy basis. Whereas here, ICE, the criminal enforcement section, is hived off into essentially a separate and independent institution where the only coordination between it and the administrative function happens at very high levels within the department, essentially the DHS headquarters level, then ICE or any criminal enforcement agency tends to see its function as doing criminal stuff and only criminal stuff. It doesn't consider the other options of civil or administrative enforcement, or at least it doesn't do so as systematically and as effectively. And the result is more criminal enforcement, I think, than we probably want. You, if the only tool you have is a hammer, they say, everything looks like a nail. And ICE only has one tool, criminal enforcement. So everything looks like a crime to it. So for me, at least, the bureaucratic separation of the two institutions does come with a kind of systematic consequences, which will have the effect of increasing our emphasis on criminal responses to the detriment of civil and administrative responses.
Just to clarify, when you say criminal, I mean, a lot of what ICE does is deporting people, right? Which is not a criminal enforcement function.
That's correct. That's correct. But it is a, it's an adversarial function, right? They take them into custody. They, as we've seen quite painfully, they hold them in detention until adjudication. Deportation enforcement has a quasi-criminal character, as opposed to, say, you know, the purely administrative proceedings that attend a notice of deportation and a notice to appear, which is still adversarial, but has less of the sound of criminal adversarialness to it. ICE has always, especially the Immigration Enforcement Group, has always been, in my experience, champing at the bit to be more aggressive and assertive in using its summary detention authorities and summary deportation authorities than it has previously been permitted to do. And it has now essentially been freed up by policy changes at the Trump administration level.
And Carrie, how much of that, as you understand ICE's enthusiasm, shall we say, is a function of the bureaucratic incentives that the structure provides? And how much of it, I don't know how to say this politely, so I'm going to say it rudely. How much of it is the fact that the workforce is just often not that great and involves a large volume of hires of people who the FBI would never touch, Secret Service would never touch, and sort of more elite federal law enforcement agencies would keep at a real distance. And so you get people who are not necessarily the most nuanced actors in the enforcement apparatus.
Well, so let me put it this way, which is to say that you've identified an issue, which is that if we looked at the education and requirements, job requirements for, say, an FBI agent or another federal law enforcement investigative agent that falls under the Department of Justice, we might find different education, training, work experience requirements than we would, for example, currently in ICE. And what I think has emerged over the last 10 to 15 years is this growth of what are now referred to within ICE of Homeland Security investigations. There is a whole component of ICE that now is conducting large-scale, complex criminal investigations, the types of investigations that in the past we might have thought the FBI was conducting, or the ATF, or the DEA.
Just to put a big underline on that point, I was stunned when Quinta and Cody and Clara Spira and I were doing our sextortion research, how many of those investigations were conducted by Homeland Security investigations, you know, which I had thought of as, you know, an immigration enforcement component. And they were doing you know, computer crimes investigations.
They're doing computer crimes. They're doing human smuggling. They're doing transnational criminal organization investigations. They have really, as the FBI shifted its mission more substantially to counterterrorism, this is the agency that picked up a lot of what was left and what U.S. attorneys' offices in particular areas of responsibility still needed to and wanted to and had a responsibility to prosecute. As a result, though, however, and this is an area where I'm hoping in the next year to do more work on, that investigative work doesn't have the same job entry requirements, doesn't have the same training, doesn't have the same attorney general guidelines, for example, that other federal law enforcement agencies have. And yet they have a large workforce, more agents. There's more federal law enforcement agents in DHS than there are in the FBI, for example, many more. And so they've taken on this responsibility. And I think that's part of the tension that we're seeing even within ICE, as evidenced by the recent letter that came out from some of the ICE special agents in charge, who they have grown to embrace this broader criminal investigative mission, and they feel like they are being unfairly tainted, if you will, by the public displeasure with the immigration enforcement piece. The irony of that is that the traditional role was the immigration enforcement piece, and it's the law enforcement complex investigative piece that has grown in a way that I think many in the public policy conversation maybe aren't aware or haven't appreciated as much.
Right. So these guys want to abolish ICE so that they can be an elite law enforcement agency. Paul, the implications of what you are saying and some of the implications of what Carrie is saying is that the decision to break up the INS was a mistake. And we've talked about it as breaking up into two components, but it's actually three, right? Because as I recall the old INS, it had not just what is now CBP and ICE, but it also had immigration adjudication functions that remained in the Justice Department while the enforcement components moved out to DHS. Is that right, Paul?
Well, that's right. And there's actually a fourth component, because there's Citizenship and Immigration Services, which is the, if you will, the nice side right. of the old INS. That's the portion that actually gives you your green card, makes you a citizen, swears you in, adjusts your status from student visa to work visa when you change. All of that is over in USCIS right now, which is also part of the Department of Homeland Security. In some ways, before I kind of answer your question directly, I want to ask a more fundamental question, which is whether or not immigration was properly thought of as a national security concern, and did it actually belong in DHS in the first instance? We obviously thought that some portions of immigration and had significant national security concerns, the border security pieces. But, you know, by and large, immigration is a foreign affairs issue. It's an economic issue. It's a foreign policy issue. It's a foreign aid issue. It's a commercial issue. It's got a lot of pieces to it. And it isn't at all clear to me that its proper place was in an agency whose principal function is, again, on counterterrorism and law enforcement, which is where DHS is.
Hang on, before you go on with that, because that's a deep issue, and let's let Carrie address it.
So, sure. So I think it'd be useful to remind our listeners why, in fact, at least from my perspective, that happened, why it went to DHS. It went to it because DHS was created after the September 11th attacks in response to the September 11th attacks. And one of the major findings was that some of the hijackers had used, abused, gotten missed by the immigration system and were here in the United States when, in fact, many of the intelligence agencies were looking at terrorist activity and focusing their efforts on potential targets of interest outside the United States. So I think that was the major driver. If we look at the top three of eight of the core functions of DHS as laid out in the very beginning of the 2002 statute, the top three priorities focus on counterterrorism. And so I think it's important that we keep that post 9/11 lens, and where I think we're at with DHS, as well as, you know, a number of other areas in sort of the national security and intelligence space, is that we are now 17 plus years out. There were all sorts of reforms that were made after September 11th, and it is completely fair and appropriate that at some point we take a step back and say, what's working? What's not? What has expanded its mission by a way, you know, beyond which we originally intended it? What needs to be recalibrated?
So I agree with both of you on this completely, that Paul's question is a totally fair one, and Carrie's answer is a totally fair one that in some ways restates the question, right? It forward dates it 17 years to now from then. But I think we have to add to it this other component, which is that the list of things that we've defined to be covered by the phrase national security is uncomfortably different in the Trump era than it was in the Bush and Obama era, right? When Bush and Obama were talking about national security and borders, they were talking about an alert border patrol person who keeps out Mohammed Khatami, turns him around in Florida, or the fact that two other hijackers managed to get in San Diego. We are not talking about the fact that, which is the way Trump talks about immigration, that large numbers of, say, people from Mexico, South America, Central America, or Muslim countries are inherently a threat to U.S. national security because they change the complexion, no pun intended, of the U.S. population. And I do think in the current environment, the phrase, the idea of national security is being used to some degree to describe something that is not conventional national security. It's conventional nativism. And I'm interested in to what extent that, like, if you define national security that way, Paul, and obviously, by the way I'm framing this, I don't want to define it that way. I think there's something really pernicious about doing it that way. But it does make the whole enterprise more inherently a national security enterprise, right?
Yeah, well, I think that's completely fair. I mean, and to, you know, to put the best spin on it that one can for the Trumpian view of these things, not a position I'm normally in the position of doing, you know, the idea of sovereignty as embodying control of one's nation's borders is not new, and it's not unique to Trump. It has echoes all the way back, you know, to the Treaty of Westphalia and natural law theorists like Emmerich Vattel, who thought that that border control was the essential function of national sovereignty. And so it's not nonsensical in a sense to want to see DHS as the embodiment of that sovereignty impulse. And if you think that, then you're probably right to want DHS to have the immigration function. I guess my reaction then, and the one that remains with me, is that that overstates the border security function and understates the dozen other types of functions that immigration proposes, ranging from labor to economics and trade and foreign affairs. And so, it again, form follows function, functions follows form. By putting it in DHS, we've made it into exclusively, if not predominantly, a national security function and enabled essentially this repurposing of the counterterrorism national security piece to a more nativist function. I don't think that the Trumpian impulse would have been nearly as successful if immigration were in the Department of Commerce, for example, where I could feasibly see it.
So is the right answer to recreate the INS, a phrase that 17 years ago nobody would have wanted to hear? Was the whole thing a big mistake, and that we inflated the national security function, we took the INS's famously awful bureaucracy that didn't work well, and we decided it couldn't work. So instead of trying to reform it and make it work the way we wanted, we simply broke it up into four different components, sent them kind of randomly or mistakenly to the far corners of the government, overinflated the national security function, and thereby enabled Trumpist nativism. Or is there more to be said for the current arrangement than that? Carrie, get us started on that. That's a big apple to bite.
So for my part, I'm going to have an unsatisfying answer, which is I'm not yet ready to commit to a recommendation on whether it should be split up, how it should be split up, whether we should reorganize, because this is an area that I want to spend time over the next year really looking at in more detail. What I will say is, you know, point I mentioned before, which is that I think it's completely fair to be asking this question and to be looking at it in a really serious way and not in a slogan type way. In other words, you know, I don't think that there should be legislation next week to abolish ICE. I think that that would be uninformed. It would contribute to the atmosphere where agents who are tasked with doing their job feel like they are under attack. I don't think that there's been enough serious work done to actually formulate something better at this point. So I think it's slightly premature to commit to it should be broken up or this is exactly how it should be reorganized. I also think that with respect to DHS, the priority of DHS and to a large extent HHS and to those who are concerned about the activities that they're seeing, I think the priority should be on the discrete, in terms of political activism, the priority should be on the discrete issue of the family separation policy and fixing that mess that was created by an ill-conceived policy idea that emanated from the White House and was implemented by the Justice Department and DHS. On your broader point about national security, sort of more broadly in the Trump administration, I think you hone in on what is going to be sort of the fundamental issue that national security practitioners are wrestling with. I know that I am with this administration, which is that how do we think about differently national security arguments that are made by the president and willing to be pursued by his cabinet and senior leadership that are not informed by evidence or intelligence information?
Or that the evidence is evidence of something that we haven't traditionally thought of as a national security outcome. So, for example, if we admit 50,000 immigrants from country X, where the people look really different, say, are much darker in complexion than the average American, and they all settle in some very white part of the United States, as, for example, happened with Somalis and Minnesota. And if not one of them commits an act of terrorism of any kind, you and I would regard that as a national security non-problem. I don't think Donald Trump regards that as a national security non-problem because he, to some degree, conflates immigration from parts of the world that he doesn't want to see coming to the United States with national security objectives.
Well, but let's be honest about it. Most of the reason that people come here from different parts of the world, aside from economic opportunity, is because they are getting out of somewhere worse. And so the Somali example, it doesn't hold that not one of them is ever involved in terrorism in the Somali community because they are coming from an area that has a native terrorist organization that then does have some reach into the community, just like not every single person who comes over the southern border is not ever going to have some connection to a criminal gang or drug cartel. It's going to happen, but that is why the majority of the people who are fleeing that come here.
Right. But I guess my point is that it is possible to define your national security goods and bads in such a way that the problem is inherent. And I'm inherent in immigration from places, say, other than Sweden. And I'm intentionally not, you know, not using words like racism here, but I am using the word nativism, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, if you define your national security objectives in such a way that inherently precludes that, well, then DHS is inherently involved in the national security business in a fashion that is much greater than the fraction that Paul assigns to it.
Yeah. Now, I'll circle back to your fundamental question about reconstituting INS. You know, back in the day, I was at least in favor of partially reconstituting INS by folding ICE back into CBP and reforming the structure. The reason we chose not to do that was that the degree of institutional disruption of all of this moving around of deck chairs is so great in the federal bureaucracy. Everything from, you know, new uniforms and new email addresses to coordinating procedures that have grown disparate over time, that even after 4 years, we didn't think the game was worth the candle. And I'd be reluctant to go down a bureaucratic reorganization road again, absent a really, really important reason to do so. And what that leads me to think, actually, is that rather than reconstituting the institution, we should focus on the more important thing, which is reconstituting the substance of immigration law. No immigration lawyer worth their salt thinks that the current structure of the law is rational. It's got 23 different visa categories, 18 exceptions, 20. I mean, it's just rococo. If we could, I mean, obviously this is a dream world and we can't do that. But if we could tear it all down and rebuild it from scratch, then we'd know what the structure is that would work.
So if I can synthesize what the two of you are saying, Carrie's saying defer bureaucratic reorganization, focus on the immediate policy problems around family disruption and separation. Paul, you're saying focus on the substantive law of immigration, and you're both kind of saying defer bureaucratic discussion until you've figured those things out and let form follow substance. Is that a fair summary?
That is a fair summary of what I think. I do, however, take a point that Carrie made earlier very seriously, which is that it's only through the mechanism of reorganization that you can actually get Congress's attention. I think that the chances of Congress, you know, reforming immigration law wholesale are basically zero. And so that's not a realistic proposal from me, even though it's the right one as a matter of policy. And perhaps we can get part of the way there by putting on the table a serious look at our current institutional structures and how they are disserving our interests in an immigration policy that is kind of comprehensive whole of government rather than exclusively national security focus.
So bottom line, Carrie, hashtag abolish ICE, useful foil for a discussion, but not a serious policy proposal at this stage?
I really feel like it's counterproductive at this point, because I feel so strongly about the discrete issue of the family separations that I feel that it encourages partisans to retreat into their partisan camps as opposed to addressing a substantive issue where I think actually there is probably wide agreement that the way that policy was unfolded was wrong and needs to be fixed.
So what should the hashtag be?
I think I'm not very good at coming up with hashtags, but I think the families belong together organizational approach in terms of fixing that discrete issue is appropriate. I think that Congress, to the extent that they want to exercise a role, I think that they should be pushing the Secretary of HHS to appoint a director and a task force and empower that individual to fix this discrete problem. And I think that's something that Congress can do and should do and really should be fairly non-controversial, because I think it's fairly obvious that the Attorney General and DHS kind of dumped this problem in Health and Human Services' lap to fix. And then beyond that, I think we do have a broader immigration law and policy question, and it's worth looking at how DHS has evolved over time. I agree with Paul that the prospects for major immigration overhaul seem unlikely, at least in the next couple years. And that's partly because even though reasonable people on all sides probably agree that things need to be fixed and modernized, the president has polarized the conversation so much and made it nationalist and ethnic based that probably a serious policy improvement is going to be hard to come by.
We're going to have to leave it there. Paul Rosenzweig, Carrie Cordero, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Thanks a lot, guys.
The Lawfare Podcast is produced today, as ever, in cooperation with the Brookings Institution. Now listen, if you're one of those people who has listened to 328 episodes of the Lawfare Podcast and has not yet gone and tweeted the Lawfare Podcast, left us a rating, and shared us on Facebook, then you are just part of the problem, and you need to think about ways to reform your life, change your habits, and become a better person. Our music is, as ever, performed by Sophia Yan, who does not need to become a better person because she has rated the Lawfare Podcast, unlike you. And as always, even if you're one of those people, thanks for listening.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. WarbyParker.com/covered.